Okay, well, thanks for coming. Good afternoon, and thanks for hanging in there. And this is great to follow on Katrina's talk because she's laid a lot of the groundwork for me. Just want to acknowledge my colleagues at Drexel, the Philadelphia Department of Health, and the Community Legal Services of Philadelphia, and just to acknowledge one of our co-investigators, Dr. Curtis Cummings, is in the audience. Okay, I have no disclosures, and of course, like all, we very much thank Robert Wood Johnson for funding this research. So Katrina's kind of laid some groundwork in terms of the whole issue of elevated blood leads in children. This is a major cause of neurodevelopmental adverse outcomes in kids, and so that's the main reason that we care about it. Lead is a neurotoxin. Major lead exposure in U.S. children is from lead-based paint hazards. In pre-1978 housing, roughly 90-some percent in Philadelphia, and particularly homes that are in poor repair with deferred maintenance. Many cities find enforcement of orders to remediate lead hazards to be difficult for multiple reasons. And I think this problem is the proverbial public health problem because there are so many stakeholders involved, the child, his parents, healthcare provider, property owner, and then, of course, the city, county, and or state authorities who make and enforce laws, ordinances, and codes. So it's a very complex problem. And this is some of the cause, the chipping and peeling, deteriorated paint. And young children basically explore the world through putting things in the mouth, the hand-to-mouth behavior. And so they touch surfaces with lead dust that comes from deteriorated paint, and hundreds of times a day are ingesting small amounts of lead to the point where it can have significant impact on their development and their intelligence. So in Philly, we have a lot of old buildings and a big problem, which has gotten better through the years. The numbers of kids with elevated blood leads have gone down drastically, but we're still talking probably 700 or 800 kids, down from thousands of kids in years ago. So the lead court, I'm going to talk about the Philadelphia lead court, and this was a process that came about after we had formed the lead abatement strike team in April 2002. The current health commissioner was instrumental in creating this program, and at the bottom you'll see folks from many, many city departments were convened regularly by the managing director to sit down and discuss lead poisoning management solutions. At that point, there was identified a backlog of 1,400 cases of properties where there had been an EBL child, a child with an elevated blood lead. The home had been inspected. Lead hazards had been found. The property owner had been ordered to remediate the property, and it had not been remediated. So this allowed for the creation of the Philadelphia Lead Court in November 2002 with a convergence of these various groups, the Health and Law Department and the Court of Common Pleas. And so this is just a diagram of the old approach, PDPH, Philadelphia Department of Public Health, with its childhood lead poisoning program. And then on the right, all of these other agencies coming together and on a very regular basis to figure out what can we do to get more of these properties remediated more quickly. And so here's the lead court. The process is that you have a child identified with elevated blood lead. The health department staff, who are certified risk assessors, go in, they evaluate the property, if they identify lead hazards, they issue orders to the property owner to remediate within 10 days and give a lot of detailed instruction on just how to do that. And so these properties then need to meet a visual reinspection where all the deteriorated paint has been removed. And then they have to meet EPA dust level compliance, which is 40 micrograms per square foot on floors and 250 on windowsills. There are some that argue that those levels are not health protective, but that's the current, you know, levels that are used by HUD properties. So just keeping that in mind. So if the property's reinspected, the owner has been non-compliant, hasn't shown any kind of good faith action that they are going to address these orders, then the what happens is the Department of Licenses and Inspections is notified of the violation, and they can revoke the owner's rental license, by which the tenant can stop paying rent, and the landlord cannot evict the tenant until the property violations are resolved. And so a copy of all this information then goes from Health Department to Law Department, and then the Law Department serves up a formal complaint and puts in copies of all of the pertinent paperwork, eliminating the "I never got it," you know, argument. And there's a copy of the complaint. And this is just a shot of the courtroom. So anyway, what did we want to know about the Philadelphia Lead Court? What we wanted to find out, is it effective? Okay. So will it improve the city's environment by decreasing the number of properties with lead hazards? And will it improve children's health by reducing exposure? And so the first question, we expected that the presence of the lead court would result in a higher rate of compliance within 1 year of the initial failed home inspection. And this analysis was done by Chi-Square, comparing different proportions in the pre- and post-court periods, and then looking at a shorter time to compliance after the initial failed inspection using Kaplan-Meier curves. And so we looked at quite a bit of data, about 4,500 unique properties, and the pre-court period was January 98 to November 15th, 02, and then the post-court was July 3rd to December 31st, 08. We did take out a transition period when the court was first established. There were a lot of backlog cases, and it really didn't represent the lead court operation as it turned out to be after that point. And so we ended up with about 4,200 properties. And then we looked at all the properties that had data at 1 year follow-up. So 3,760 of those, and then we looked at what percent were compliant at the one-year mark. So in the pre-court houses on the left, we had 102 became compliant, which was 6.6%, and on the right, 1,706 properties, 76.8% compliance. So striking increase in number of remediated properties and percent of those with lead violations. And the bottom row just shows the ones that were not compliant. And so this is, you know, a dramatic presentation, the black bars being the percent compliant versus the non-compliant. And then we looked at time to compliance by the court period. So the pre-court is in blue on the bottom, and the green is court era properties, and the proportion compliant is on the left. On the bottom are the number of months, and we basically had good data up to about 48 months. And so when we looked at 4 years or 48 months later, we found that there wasn't a whole lot of additional compliance. It only got up to 18% in the pre-court properties and 83% in the court. But still, the differences were quite dramatic in terms of number of compliant properties. Study question two, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but we just looked at all the properties that achieved compliance. We just looked at the trend in terms of children's blood leads 6 months prior, and then 6 months after compliance, and 12 months after compliance. And did an analysis of variance on properties that had data at all those time periods, and then we dichotomized into pre-court and court era, and then into younger children, older children. And basically the bottom line, what I want you to just look at is the GM or geometric mean for Precourt on the top. So it went from about 20.5 down to 12.8, 12 months post-compliance. And in the court group, the same downward trend, starting at relatively lower LEADS, but the same trend. And so for both court groups, BLED LEADS do decrease over time. They were lower in the court group, and but they didn't decrease one group faster than the other. And the levels were lower in the court group because it was a later point in time. And as some of the other speakers have mentioned, the prevalence of elevated blood leads has gone down drastically nationally and also in Philadelphia. We think that might be due to some, maybe due to attrition of the worst properties through demolition, but also could be increased education for parents and healthcare providers in terms of knowing more about the issues. So this just shows for the little kids less than 2 years and the older kids two and older. Again, the geometric mean goes down over time. It does go down more quickly in the younger group versus the older group, and they're higher in the older children. This is just diagrammatically shows that the red is the older children and the blue younger. And kids typically peak blood leads around 2 years, maybe two and a half. So it's, you know, not too surprising that the older kids had higher levels. Then we looked at factors that predicted time to compliance. I'm going to go through this very quickly, but using a proportional hazards model, we found that if you were in the court group, you were 8 times more likely to achieve compliance, but none of the other factors, the age of the child at the first inspection, the first blood lead, or the owner status of the property, none of those were significant. So let's see. This is just about HUD grants. If I have time, I'll take questions. We did find that the availability of a HUD lead hazard control grant did increase the possibilities of the properties getting remediated. This is just a nice little quote saying that there are so many elements to childhood lead poisoning in terms of it being public health, a housing issue, a housing stock issue, landlord-tenant issue. You know, it's just everything wrapped into one public health condition. And so in closing, the conclusion was that the court was very effective and the pre-strategy was not. We don't know if it would have been as effective without the last program or without the fairly large availability of HUD grants. We do think this does support preventive proactive policies, which we're trying to get through in Philadelphia. Also, it does prove, I think, that property owners, if they're held accountable, will, in most cases, respond to enforcement and court orders, you know, to remediate. And lastly, I think this could be replicated in other cities that have similar lead prevalence of lead hazards in housing. Thank you very much.
So in answer to the sort of initial pessimistic question we had about how difficult it is to do this, looking at lead, targeted attacks on the sources, better enforcement, a couple of different mechanisms we can make enforcement better, as well as looking at how you can think of having less lead around to use in the first place and people be exposed to. So that's been a really inspiring set of presentations. Thank you very much. And we have a good 10 minutes for questions. So I'll ask our panel to answer them. Why don't you? We'll kind of huddle around here and look warm and forthcoming to answering questions. Yes?
To the last speaker, I just had a question about the post-EBL in home inspection. We have a similar law where I am, and we were debating whether we could take it to other residents besides the primary residence of the child with blood poisoning, and also go back and look at children who were residing in that home prior to the current tenant and get them blood tested. Have you done any expansion to other homes?
Well, in general, the health department will go out on a second or third property if it seems to be that there may be significant exposure. And those were probably lumped in, you know, to these groups, because these were groups of properties. And then we had, an index child for each property. So that is some percent of the lead exposure, probably not a whole lot, but, you know, it's a good point that sometimes it is more than one property.
So there's definitely, in general, lead poisoning is considered a major environmental justice issue. Children from lower-income households, children from non-white racial groups are much more likely to experience lead poisoning. For most of those kids, the paint hazards actually remain the predominant source. So there's a large group of kids who are getting some exposure from water and a small group of kids who are getting most of their exposure from water. They're actually mostly younger. So I think Carla mentioned that from paint, it peaks at around 2 or 2.5 because of the hand-to-mouth behavior. From water, it's actually bottle-fed kids whose parents are making infant formula with the tap water that is lead-contaminated. And since some screening programs don't actually even look at kids that young, right, because they're sort of screening for the paint, so they're screening 18-month-olds, 24-month-olds, we don't have good data. There is a sense that it is an environmental justice problem, and there is certainly a sense that there is an issue with lower-income families being less likely to say yes to pipe replacement because of the cost issue. So in Washington so far, which is where we've actually done the structured interviews with the homeowners, many of those are more sort of middle-class single-family homes. In Providence, we actually will be talking to more families that are lower income and environmental justice areas, so we'll have more data about what the factors are that maybe are keeping people away from participating in the lead service line replacement programs. No. One of the sort of fundamental sort of regulatory structure questions we wrestle with is the regulated entity under the Safe Drinking Water Act is a public water utility. EPA doesn't have the authority to tell anybody who's not a public water utility what to do. Just like in some local lead laws, you can tell rental property owners what to do, but you can't tell single-family homeowners what to do, right? So that's why we're sort of trying to figure out if there's a way to kind of redefine what constitutes the utility to reach across the property line. But then what we said in our proposal to Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and sort of the second phase of work that we'll be doing in the first part of 2012 is if the Safe Drinking Water Act just does not create a regulatory framework that makes sense for those situations where the problem extends beyond the utility as the contributor, you know, what other regulatory regimes would make sense, and that's why we're looking at some of the lead paint stuff, the disclosure stuff, the financial aid, as a model, because, you know, why reinvent the wheel? We've been wrestling with this on paint for decades.
What kind of work?
Well, with the data I showed, it was secondary prevention, basically. Once the child was poisoned, then the owner was ordered, and that was because of this local health code, you know, that the owner was in violation of. But now that we are trying to get a prospective law passed in Philly through the city council, that would just be rental properties, because frankly, I think that's much easier than trying to get all properties. There has been a group of health advocates, children's advocates on one side, and then property owners on the other, citing, you know, mostly the expense, but other issues as well. And we are trying to get some type of dedicated funding for the remediation work. You know, granted, it is very expensive now. You know, some of us feel that's probably the price of doing business if you own property and you're renting out and collecting rent money, that, you know, that's part of that responsibility. But it has been an issue in terms of trying to get a proactive policy that would be more similar to Rochester. And it's tough because you've got, you know, different groups sort of going against each other. Not everybody is looking out for the welfare of the health of children, unfortunately.
Yes?
Are people rolling in the whole healthy homes concept now in terms of looking at lit and healthy homes? And if so, what type of acceptance of healthy homes in special conditions is that you guys are going to be getting?
Well, I can speak for Philadelphia. The health department, the Cook program, has sort of expanded into lead and healthy homes, and there have been a couple of preventive programs for private housing, and then for foster care homes, and then the biggest program has been for daycares, family daycares, small daycares that are run out of private homes. And all of that's voluntary, and so the remediations, you know, are certainly limited by funding, but they're also voluntary for the property owner. You know, the department is trying to get them done, but it is voluntary. There's no way to order that.
Well, I think we have come. Oh, we have time for one more. Sure, one more question.
I just have a quick question. In Omaha, Nebraska, the Section 8 properties, they're supposed to do a lead dust white test after renovation. However, that had not been happening in Omaha. And the same with if a child has been poisoned, the home was still receiving Section 8 funding. And obviously, there was just actually recently last month an evaluation of those violations, and now they have to. But do you have any more experience with that, where federal organizations or other organizations have been not following rules?
Yeah, I mean, I, as a provider of kids with, you know, lead poisoning and EBLs, we did a lot of battling with the Philadelphia Housing Authority, and that also runs the Section 8 program. But after the last process in 2002, the PHA folks, the Philadelphia Housing Authority folks, were at the table as part of this last task force. And I think it made a big difference because they really got much more hardcore. They started enforcing, they started doing the inspections, and they started getting rid of landlords that wouldn't clean up the properties. They weren't going to get the subsidies. So I think it's possible, but I really think that the last task force structure helped all the various agencies to really think what's their part, you know, what's their responsibility, and to take it a little more seriously. So it helped to be able to enforce that.
I just wanted to comment that in Rochester, we tried really hard to write a law that was going to be very efficient and not duplicate effort and be a partnership between different agencies. So we explicitly exempted Section 8 housing. But in terms of initial implementation, the city decided to ignore that because they didn't trust the Section 8 inspectors. Because for that particular period of time, Section 8, again, this theme of government cost saving, had decided to use private inspectors. and the city didn't trust the private inspection mechanism. Section 8 learned, our local Section 8 discovered that they didn't trust the local people either, the private inspectors either, and have taken them back in-house. And so now the city is actively excluding Section 8 housing from their inspection. So, you know, we actually have confidence it's working well, but it took quite a while of relationship building and sort of quality control. And that's something that, again, the lesson learned is that can shift over time. So we also have county-assisted, state-assisted housing, and had also written into the law a targeting strategy that relied on that. The county, without any announcement or working with the city, revoked that about a year and a half ago. And, you know, if you saw my last slide, that was about 6 months before our EBL letter numbers went up. We can't say causation, et cetera, but that's the only significant change in our legal environment.
Okay.